Good morning. My name is Sheila, and I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. I was afraid of how I was going to be introduced this morning. I was warned that there might be a few of the comments about what's transpired this weekend, such as my being in the bed with her husband and his invitation to go fiddling and these kinds of things, and I thought, well, you know, I could live with that. I got up this morning and I thought, well, you know, this has to be this is really a privilege to be here. It really is, and I wanted it to go well, and so I planned what I was going to wear, and I got up early and I showered and dressed and. And I thought, well, you know, I'm really going to make it. It's really going to be okay. And had some quiet time scheduled with my husband. We took a walk and went to the chapel this morning. And on the way back over here, I looked down and I got this big runner in my stockings. And I thought, well, you know, it's God working in my life. You know, every time I need a lesson in humility, I get it. But I really do think this is a neat place to be, and I really, really am privileged to be here today. I would like to begin my story by telling you that I did not grow up in an alcoholic home. I think I came from a normal family. Now today, recently I heard a speaker say, you know, every family was dysfunctional. You know, you might not understand the word, but the way we look at it today and look back on things, every family was dysfunctional. Well, I didn't think that of my family. I thought that they were normal for the times, and my dad was, well, they worked really hard, and they had a bunch of kids, and they just, you know, he ruled the roost, and she didn't rock the boat, and that's kind of the way it was, and I thought that was normal. I think that's normal today for the way they were raised. But when I got in Al-Anon, I looked back at that and I thought, I need to do things different. So I immediately had a hysterectomy, quit my job, and with four females in the family, my husband never had another chance to say jump. So that's neat. I think I am so grateful for Al-Anon for the opportunity that I have had to learn a different way of life. And I was made aware of the little story about the butterfly. When I come to these things, this Juanita's all decked out in butterflies and everybody wears these butterflies and they're just everywhere. I didn't know for a long time what the significance of the butterfly was, and there's lots of stories, you know, about the butterflies. But the bottom line for me is that it's kind of the story of an ugly worm that builds a cocoon around itself and shuts itself off from the world. But with God's intervention, then eventually this creature breaks out of that cocoon and becomes a beautiful creature that flies away freely to enjoy life. That's what Al-Anon has done for me. And I love that, you know, and that concept. Because that's where I am with it, you know. I don't think I'll ever be able to express the gratitude I have for this program. But at any rate, I did not set out to marry an alcoholic and live miserably ever after. Just one of those things that happened in my life, you know. I grew up in this hardworking family and we learned how to work and be responsible and there were seven of us kids and we all had to pull our share of the weight and help things along. My parents both worked, and they worked long hours, and so we were kind of left to grow up on our own. We were kind of supervised from a distance, so we learned how to work real well, but we didn't learn how to play. or have fun. And we didn't have a lot of time for family functions and get-togethers and social things. And so this was something that was lacking in my life. And so when I graduated from high school, the next normal step for me was to get a job and get married and go on about my life. Well, I was aware that I wasn't very happy in this working existence, and so I went looking for happiness. And I found a guy that knew how to play, and he was really a party guy, you know, and he was fun to be with, and he spent a lot of money, and I learned later he stole it, but... But we had a good time, you know, and I thought, this is my ticket to happiness. This is what I need. And this is it. And so, I set about fulfilling the promise I had made to myself to find happiness in this life. And so I looked at this guy and I thought, well, he does have a few rough edges. But I thought, I can polish them up. You know, it's kind of a diamond in the rough. and so that was my goal in life. You know, a lot of gals marry for money, and some of us marry for love, and I marry for potential. I could really see that he had potential, and I was going to help him develop that. I was going to shape him up into what I thought he should be, and the result of that was happiness ever after, and we would go down the path, you know, and that would be it. But little did I know, I was dealing with alcoholism full blown at that point in time. It truly is cunning and baffling and powerful. I was totally in the dark. I tried. I was very naive when I entered this marriage, and so I kind of had an idea of what would cause this happiness to come about in my life, and it was you know, if the love of a good woman and perseverance. My upbringing provided me the message that, you know, if I worked hard enough and stuck with it, I could have anything I wanted, and so this is what I wanted. And so I set about my task of working to make this thing work, and I just put my all into it. I tried all kinds of things. In the beginning, you know, it was we did a lot of partying stuff and had a good time, but at some point in time the evening generally turned sour. Not always, but generally, you know, and so I would try to ward off these attacks and try to stay one step ahead of him. Now, if you've ever tried to stay one step ahead of a drunk, you've got your stuff cut out for you. It never happened. But at any rate, I tried these things. I had kind of a mental list of possible solutions to this problem, and I went down the list and I tried them. Sometimes I drink with him, sometimes I would not go with him. You know, just anything that came to mind, then I would try it. I was responsible for our first geographical cure. We grew up in a neighborhood that had a mom-and-pop grocery store on one corner and a neighborhood beer joint on another corner and a Catholic church down the street and a little neighborhood park in the middle, you know. And so it was kind of self-contained, and you didn't have to go very far to get your needs met. And all this convenience is what I thought was our problem. So we had an opportunity to buy a home in Oldham County. Now, I really pushed this and persuaded him to buy this house, number one, because it's in a dry county. Number two, because it's a good deal on a house. So we moved primarily as a geographical cure. I wanted to get him out of this neighborhood where these things were convenient. Now, the only thing that happened was that he ended up wrecking all of our cars because he'd have to drive across from Oldham County across Jefferson County to get to where he worked. And we had what I eventually termed disposable cars. They would only last 2 or 3 weeks, and he would wreck them, and we'd throw them away. So we paid $200 for the cars because, I mean, they don't have to run very long or very, very well for to be wrecked, you know. So we had these disposable cars, and they kind of caused me a problem. His drinking always caused me problems. I didn't know that they were causing him any problems, but it caused me problems. And this didn't begin with our marriage; it began with our dating. We dated a couple of years, and there was always some bargaining in there. So from the very beginning, his drinking was a problem to me. So that's where I started. Day one, trying to find solutions, trying to find the answer to his drinking and to prevent it. And so, hence the geographical cure, which did not work. And then I thought, well, maybe he just needs a little bit more responsibility. We've been married several years by this time and had one daughter, and so I planned our second child because he needed to have an anchor tied to him, you know? And this second child and this added responsibility did not work either. And so it was just one thing after another. Each time I tried something, I failed. The more I failed, the more I picked myself up by my bootstraps and tried again. You know, it was just self-perpetuating, and I tried and I never gave up because of my upbringing. It was not cool to quit. You know, you just hung in there. And I think I was really too dumb to quit, you know. I just couldn't think past getting this goal met that I had set for my life. As the time went on and the drinking progressed, he became more and more unable to function in the capacity that I expected. And as a result of that, I picked up more and more of the responsibility for the family. And I went to work, and I paid the bills, and I banked the money, and I took charge. And the only thing that he had left at the end, the only thing that he was in charge of was cutting the grass and taking out the garbage, and he didn't do that right. I did everything else, you know. I worked and I paid the bills and I kept the cars maintained and the house and I raised the kids and all of these things, and all he had to do was take out the garbage, and he didn't do that right. Well, we booked along in a normal alcoholic marriage for quite some time, and I was getting irritable and unreasonable, to say the least. And then one day God walked into my life, and I got just a tiny glimpse at sanity. This just wasn't the way everybody else lived, you know. I had looked, and by this time it's 15 years into our relationship. We had dated a couple of years and married about 13 years by this time, and I just knew that I had wasted 15 years of my life. And reality was, I didn't want to waste another 15 years. And so I made the decision that I wanted out of this marriage. I just wanted out. And I knew that I had to plot my way out. I couldn't just go to him and say, look, you know, this is over. This is not working out. I'll see you later. He was kind of a Jekyll and Hyde type of a personality, and I know a lot of you are familiar with that. He was prone to violence when he got drunk, and namely because, I think today, I would get my little digs in when he was coming off a drunk, and then he would get real mad because he'd remember those things, and he'd get drunk, and then he'd come home. I had become the disciplinarian in our family, and I had these little kids over here, and he was acting just like the kids, so I put him in that category, you know. And I doled out the punishment when they were bad, and rewarded them when they were good. And I tried to be very conscientious about this situation and let the punishment fit the crime. And so if his offense was not very serious, his punishment wasn't too bad. And it's like when we lived in this home in Oldham County, we were kind of out in a rural setting, 5 miles to the nearest grocery store, and probably 10 or 15 miles to the nearest beer joint. But the grocery store was my main thing, and I knew, you know, if he would be drunk on Friday night and he really didn't cause me a whole lot of trouble, then the next day I would get even, but I would think through what I was going to do to him this time. And sometimes I would just simply fix his breakfast. You know, this loving wife, fixing his breakfast because I knew he was sick and he didn't feel well. And so I'd fry up all this bacon and eggs, and you could just smell this going through the house, and I'd hear him in the bathroom upchucking, and I'd put on some more bacon because that delighted me. I thought, you know, if I'm suffering, he's going to suffer as well. And sometimes I would go through the medicine cabinets and I would collect all of the aspirin and all of the pain medication, and I would hide it. And he'd have a head out to here, and he'd say, "Get me something for my headache." And I'd say, "I'm sorry, we don't have anything." Knowing he's not going to get up and get dressed and go to the grocery store. You know, that's just not the thing to do. And he would not believe me, and he'd get up and he'd search the medicine cabinets, and sure enough, it would be empty, you know. And I'd think, suffer, you know. And one time I can remember, he did something really bad. I needed him. I had a family emergency at home, you know, and so I called down at the beer joint, and this is before I took the relocation. He was down at the beer joint, and I needed him. And so I called down there, and they said, "He's not here." You know, the pat answer that bartenders have. "He's not here." Well, I knew he was, and I got aggravated, and I went over there, and sure enough, his car was sitting there next to the curb. And I was really ticked off, and I thought, well, you know, and this didn't take 5 seconds to plan. You know how you get real quick when you have some emergencies. You just take instant action. Well, I looked at his car, and I remembered that he wasn't there, and I needed him and all this stuff. And so I decided, I had been watching television. See, I got a lot of my education on television, and I knew about car wrecks and whiplash and all these things. And if your car is going forward and it hits a fixed object, then you get whiplash. And I thought, I don't want to do that, but I need to do something. So I pulled my car down the street about a half a block and put it in reverse and backed up and broadsided his car and set it up on the sidewalk, and I went home. Well, the next day, the guys at the beer joint, you know, were talking and laughing about this. Isn't that funny what Sheila did? And he said, "Well, what did she do?" "She did that to your car." He said, "No, uh-uh." So he got on the phone. He said, "Did you do this?" And I said, "Who, me? You know, would I do something like that?" So I learned to tell half truths. And I learned to be real evasive. And I learned that in order to get rid of this frustration and this anger that I had on the inside, I had to get even. And so that's the way my life was. And so now you'll understand a little bit better how when I got down to that 15-year point and I'm saying, you know, I've wasted my life, you know, that I really needed to do something different. And so I began plotting my way out of this marriage, and I had a mental list of things that needed to be done in order for me to be self-sufficient and independent. I had left many times during the rough times, and when he had suffered enough, I'd come back, you know. But this time it was different. I was finished. I wanted to do something to be free of this type of life. I wanted to live another way of life. I didn't know what was out there, but I knew there had to be something. And so I began taking care of the list of things that I had to do. Now, in retrospect, I realized that what I actually did was detach from him. And they talk about detachment with love in Al-Anon. And at that point in time, if you had told me about that concept, I would not have believed it. I would not have accepted it. Because I truly felt no love for this man. He was just a burden. He was a thorn in my side, and I just needed to get rid of it. And there was no love. I had not allowed love in my life for some time. So I had a list, and I had to sell the home because I wasn't going to walk away from that. You know, I needed a start in another location. There had to be some distance between us. I had to have a dependable car, you know, one that would run for a while. And I had to be able to support three children by this time. And so it took me a couple of years to kind of go down this list and touch base with all these things and finalize my preparation. And it was exhausting. It truly did zap all of my energy because I was trying to appear innocent and not let him find out what was going on. But still, I had to tell him we were going to sell the house, you know. He had signed papers. So it was really a challenge for me to work both sides of the street. But I accomplished this. You know, I'd tell him stories about things, you know, and I would convince him that this was the right thing to do, and sort of like the way he works with me now, you know, tell him what his benefits are and then he can be persuaded. That's the way it is today with me. You know, he'll tell me what my benefits are and then I can be persuaded. And so this is what I did, and it took me a couple of years to go down the list and do these things. So one day I was finished, and I was not going to sneak out in the middle of the night. This was going to be my grand finale. This was going to be a production. You know how in the Western movies the music comes up, you know, and the hero rides off in the sunset and all that. This is going to be the production. And I was prepared to go to him and say to him, this is what I've done, this is what I'm going to do, and you are going to be sorry. I'm not going to be in your life anymore, and you're going to suffer for this. And he chose to get sober. I was mad. I didn't get to do all this stuff. You know, he ruined my production. But evidently this detachment that I had done, for two years I had got on with my life. I had made decisions that were good for me. I had let go of his drinking. I didn't get on his case anymore. I didn't insist that he be home at a certain time for dinner. If he was not there, we ate. If he said, well, I'm going to stop and have a couple of beers and I'll be on home, we'll go out to dinner. As soon as I hung up the phone, I'd get the kids dressed and we'd go out to eat. I had no expectations of him. I just truly didn't care. I wanted him out of my life. You know, I wanted to be done with him. And so now that all of this has come to pass, he got sober. What that did for me was it put me back on the fence. Do I leave or do I stay? And I didn't like making decisions. I'd only made two decisions in my whole life up to this point. And one of them was to marry him and one of them was to unmarry him. And so now I've got another decision to make. You know, what am I going to do? And this is when God truly became apparent in my life. I instinctively asked God for help. In the big book, it talks about one of the promises being that you will intuitively know how to handle things that used to baffle you. Well, I immediately knew what I needed to do in this situation. But I'm saying, now, wait a minute, that's not what I want to do, you know? I wanted him sober, and I wanted him to be the husband and the father that I had programmed in my mind. And the first stepping stone to that was not drinking. And he was doing something about his drinking at this point in time. And so I was confused. But this thought kept coming back to my mind, consider the source. You know, I had gone to God for help in this situation, and this was different. Before this point in my life, I had never considered God a source of strength. God, in my mind, was someone to be feared, someone that was punishing, someone that was kind of intangible up there in the clouds. And my concept of God was a situation kind of like this. There was this lectern or podium, and there was this big book, and he was looking over on the side down at me. And every time I screwed up, I got a black mark in that book. And I didn't know how many black marks it took to qualify to go to hell, but I figured that I had earned my stripes, you know. So I hid from God. You know, I didn't want to be out there in the open. I didn't want him to see what I was doing, because I was really vicious. So now God's in my life, you know, and I know I got to leave this guy. But I don't want to, because he's getting sober. So the thought that was going through my mind was consider the source. And I thought, well, if you talk to God, and this is what the message you received was from God, then you better get your rear end in gear and do it. So I packed up and left. And I moved out of town with my children and my furniture on Labor Day weekend of 1975. He had gotten sober August 21st, 1975. So in a matter of a week or so, you know, it took me to wrestle with this new input in my life, you know, and take some action. And I look back at that now, and I know that's the first three steps. I know that I surrendered, totally surrendered to a higher power, and I acted on his guidance. And I turned my life and my will over to him that day. I was not conscious of this, and I didn't understand it until much later when I got into Al-Anon, but that's what happened, you know. So we were separated a year or so, and he was getting his stuff together in AA, and he would come to visit us because he was determined that he wanted to give it one more shot. And each time he came to visit us, he was a little bit more put together, and he was a little bit more happy, and he was a little bit more dependent, and he was a little bit more responsible, and he became attractive to me. They say this is a program of attraction. Well, I was being attracted. And so after a while, I decided, well, yeah, you know, rather than keep up two households, I'll come back and we'll live. But I had not made a commitment to our marriage yet, because I didn't trust him. And I thought, you know, this is another manipulation. I'm going to get taken down the path one more time. So I didn't trust. I had built up a wall of insulation around myself. That cocoon I was talking about, that was me. I was living in that cocoon. I had no feelings. And I had no trust. I didn't trust the mailman, particularly my alcoholic husband. And so it was a practical decision for me to come home and live under the same roof with him. And he had been going to AA for a while, and he continued to go to AA. He was gone more in sobriety than he was gone when he was drinking. You know, he was just gone all the time. And he did me a favor. He detached from me. He cut me loose. And he said, I have to do what I have to do to stay sober. So I'm going to meetings, and you're welcome to go with me, and I'd love for you to go with me, but if you don't go, I'm going anyway. And he did. And he left me home to wallow in my misery and to look at my very small world and to come to grips with that. And so one Friday night, he says, would you like to go to a meeting? And I said, yes. I needed somebody taller than 3 feet to talk to. I needed to get out of the house, so I considered this my Friday night date. I thought, hell, you know, if he's going to take me to an AA meeting, I'll go, you know, if that's the only place. And I experienced the fellowship of this program. And the fellowship is what kept me coming back to Al-Anon for a long time. Kept me coming back, period. I wasn't in Al-Anon at this point in time, but it kept me coming back. And the Friday night meeting led to a Saturday night card game at someone's house, and that led to a sponsor, and the sponsor led to meetings, and the meetings led to steps, and so it kind of set off a chain reaction in my life, and it was good, and I enjoyed it, and I was booking along, you know, and going to these meetings, and I identified him right away as one of you all, because I knew that he needed help. Now, I didn't realize I had any problems or that I had been affected by this disease of alcoholism. I had justified everything I'd ever done. And I was right in what I had done. And because he obviously was wrong. He was the bad guy and I was the good guy, you know, and you have to balance the scales, right? So it was him or me, black or white. And as I continued to come to these meetings, there came a crack in the dike, and some information started to seep in. You see, I had never discussed my situation with anyone. I heard a gal talk recently, and she talked about this committee meeting. Well, my committee met regularly. And it was just me that attended those board meetings, and I had discussions with myself, and I based my decisions and acted on them based on those decisions, you know. So I had limited input to these meetings, you know. Well, with my coming to meetings, some other people's input started to seep in, and I started to think, and I started to identify, and I started to relate, and I started to question whether or not I was this perfect person that I thought I was, you know. Intellect kicked in, and I made an intellectual decision. It's always intellect versus emotion in my life. Intellect says nothing is 100%. Therefore, I have to have one character defect someplace. But I couldn't find it. So I go to my sponsor and I discuss this, you know, and she said, well, maybe you're just trying too hard. Maybe you ought to let God come in there and he'll show you these things when you're able to handle them. And he won't give you more than what you can handle. And I believe that. By this time I had become teachable. I had wanted so desperately to live differently than the way I used to live. And I was determined not to go back. So whatever people told me in this program to do, I did it. I made protests for a short period of time, but I'd do it because they'd say, this is good for you. This is good for you. And I'd do it. And sure enough, it was good for me, you know. And I started to grow in this program, and they say if you bring the body, the mind follows. And that's what happened to me. I found this Al-Anon meeting. It was suggested by my husband through my sponsor that I go to Al-Anon. And he said, would you call her? And so she said she would. So she called and she said, would you like to go to a meeting with me tonight? And I said, sure. And she said, well, what time are you going to pick me up? And I've learned that there's a lot of little tricks out there, you know, that we use on new people that, you know, and I had obligated myself to pick her up. Therefore, I could not renege on the commitment to go to the meeting. And so I went, and I was having, at this point, this early point in my recovery, I was suffering from depression. The hopelessness and the helplessness and all this jazz, and it was never going to be any better, and I was finding fault with everything, and I just never had any positive side to my life. It was all negative, and it was feeding on itself. And so I go to this meeting, and I said in my arrogant way, they said that you would help me with my depression. Now fix it. And this little lady's about 5 feet tall. She came over and she put her arms around me and she said, come on in, honey, we've got a seat for you. Well, I didn't know then, but they put the really sick ones on the front row. So if y'all go to a new meeting and they say, come on up here, honey, watch it. But it was good for me because in this meeting they were not talking about what he was doing or what he had done to them. They were talking today about what I can do in my life to feel better about me, how I can use these tools, the program, and how I can put the steps in my life to get my stuff together. And I thought, I have arrived. I was so glad to be there. And so I made a commitment to go religiously to Al-Anon. And I went once every 6 weeks. And it did help. But someone told me that, you know, this thing is proportionate. The more you put into it, the more you get back. And so I would take these crash courses. And I'd go 7 days, or and then I'd go 30 days, or then I'd go 2 days, or whatever it was, you know, whatever I thought was appropriate. But I began to get the hang of it. They told me to stick with the winners. And I didn't know what the steps meant. I thought the slogans that you see in the Al-Anon meetings were just dumb stuff. I really thought I was in a kindergarten room. And, you know, and I read those things and I understood the meaning of the word, but I didn't understand the meaning of the concept. So, but they said stick with the winners. And in this initial meeting that I went to, there were a lot of couples and we did a lot of social things together. And through these social meetings, I had an opportunity to begin to talk with these people and to begin to know them, and they shared their life with me, and I shared my problems with them, and so I began to get feedback, and I began to mimic their behavior, and I began to do what they were doing, still not having any idea that I had already begun to work the steps in my life, simply because I'm doing what they were doing, and they had the handle on these things. And so I stuck with the winners. And I began to come to meetings regularly, and I began to listen, and I began to identify me, you know. Went to open AA meetings, and this is where I started to relax my position where my alcoholic husband was concerned, because I took everything he had done personally to me. He did this to me. And I learned in those open AA meetings through hearing other people's stories that he did what he did because he was driven by the compulsion of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism had control of his life, and he did those things simply because he was alcoholic. And then in a little while, I learned that this is a family disease, and that I, too, had been affected by the disease of alcoholism, and that the things that I had done were simply a reaction to the circumstances at the time. And I was compelled to do what I did because I knew nothing different either. And so we were on this merry-go-round, and that was the disease of alcoholism. And so what I could do at this point in time was to put all of that past in a box and tie it up with string and throw it away. I was done with the past. And I didn't have to bring it up to him and say, don't you remember 25 years ago when you did this? That was no longer existent. I no longer was angry at him toward the past. I forgave myself for what I had done in the past. And I started my life over at that point in time. And I started to grow from there. I learned about compassion. I'd go to meetings and they would be discussing these things, and I'd think, I don't know what that is. And I'd go home and I'd pray for it, which is a mistake sometimes, because you always get what you pray for. So I went home one time and I prayed for compassion. And there was a set of circumstances that came about in my life where we had this little business, and I had invited all of these people over for a Christmas get-together. And I was very positive about this. You know, I had begun reading the You Can Do It books, and you're okay. And I really felt like a positive attitude was needed. And so I was real positive with this thing, that this was going to come off. And as the day wore on in the evening, and it became apparent that other people didn't have this as their number one priority in life, you know, a few days before Christmas. So no one was, it became apparent that no one was going to come. And my children came to me and said, well, Mom, what are you going to do if nobody shows up? And I'd say, they're going to be here. They're going to be here, you know. So I said, don't worry about it, you know. And I kept the positive thought. And the party was scheduled for 8 o'clock, and 5 minutes to 8, there's nobody ringing my doorbell. All of a sudden, the thought goes through my mind, you don't have to be strong. If you're hurt, you can be hurt. If you're sad, you can be sad. And then the tears came because I was hurt. And my kids came up and hugged me and said, hey, Mom, you know, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And with that, I learned compassion, because the next time they hurt, I knew what that felt like. And I could go and I could hug them and console them. And that was terrific. I asked God for money one time. We had this little business and it was floundering. Neither of us knew how to conduct a business. We'd always been hourly employees. And we had this brainstorm idea one time, and we quit our jobs and we were going to start this little business. We had enough sense to know that a business takes time to develop and grow and be profitable. So we borrowed money from the bank, put a second mortgage on the house. And so we lived on this money until the business could get started. And the business didn't get started, but we spent the money. So one day, you know, I've got this stack of bills here to be paid, and I've got no income coming in. And they had talked about let go and let God in this program. And I thought, okay, I need some money. And I said, God, I need money to pay these bills. In a couple of days, we had a hailstorm. And the hail pitted our roof and dented our car. And the insurance company came down to make a settlement, and they normally, in these cases, make the check payable to the mortgage company and the homeowner so that they can be assured that the work gets done. They gave me the check. I said, thank you, God, and I paid the bills. Smeared a little tar on the roof, and it was good for another 5 years. And I keep going back to that first surrender that I made prior to coming into this program. And that became the cornerstone of my spiritual growth. Whenever I have doubts that God works in my life or will do for me what he's doing for you all, then I go back and I remember that event. And I knew, even though I didn't want to leave my husband at that point in time when he looked like he was doing so good, because I did and because I followed that act of faith, that has really made an impact in my life. And so anytime I have a doubt, I go back and say, yeah, you know, it started there. And look at all these other events. When you've asked God for help and you've put yourself in his care, hasn't he done good? And I'd say, yeah, you know, I was, I did not have a good loving concept of God, and I would, when I began to test the fact that He would work in my life, I would give Him these little projects to work on, and I'd say, "Okay, God, you're doing this for them, do this for me," and it would turn out okay, and I'd think, "Ah, that was a fluke, you know, try this one," and He'd do that one okay too. And every time I have gone to God for help, I have gotten what I needed. Now, what I did learn how to do, though, was to let go of His methods. I had to quit telling Him how to do it and when to do it. And so today I just put it in His hands and I walk away from it. And it works out. It just works out. And it's the little stuff. The way I got started on this doing this, turning this thing over, was I heard a guy talk one time, and he talked about God making this universe and nature and the way it recycles itself and all these gorgeous things that we have and all this good that has come to us. And he said, "Now, if He can do all of this, what makes you think He can't deal with that finance company?" And so I said, "All right." So I started giving Him the finance company, you know. And it got down to the little stuff, you know, losing my car keys. He helps me find my car keys, helps me do everything. Now, I still have a very reverent concept of God, and I do hold Him up here. I don't think I can ever put Him down next to me or elevate myself up to where He is. I just don't think that I'll ever be able to do that. But I do have a trust today, and I do have a faith that I never would have believed possible. Heard a guy talk one time in AA, and he talked about a glass house and how someone in this program would be watching his every move, that he would no longer be able to keep secrets. And I thought, that's fantastic. And so I adopted that attitude. You know, I found out that we're all here for the same reasons. We've all pretty much done the same things. And so it's no big deal when I start doing some of these things. But what is the big deal is that I admit it and I do something different to change it. So today I don't have a lot of secrets. I live in that glass house. I think everybody in the city of Louisville knows what happens in our house. You know, we go to meetings and we talk about it. You know, we just don't have any secrets. Love is another problem that I had when I first came into Al-Anon. I talked with my sponsor and I said, "I don't feel toward my husband like I felt when we, early on when we were married. You know, I don't feel love for him. How do I know if I love him because of all this stuff that had transpired in our past? How do I know that I'm done with that? Because I don't feel for him." And she said, "Well, you know, love is a lot of little things. It's not the big stuff, it's the little things, you know." And so after our discussion, I became aware of my husband in my life. And when I was ironing his shirts, you know, I'd say, "Gee, you know, this really looks good on him." And when I'd go to the grocery store and do the grocery shopping, I'd think, "I think he'd like to have this for dinner tonight. And I liked his cologne, you know." And so I became very much aware of him in my life, and those little feelings started to rekindle. And today I know that I love my husband. I have the respect of our children, and I know that they love me. I get excited when they include me in their life. You know, I have a 3-year-old granddaughter who's just delightful, and all of our children are adult now. Our youngest is 18, and she's off to college. But the two older daughters and the granddaughter are more available these days for me. And so we do a lot of shopping and a lot of fun things together. And one of my daughters told me recently, said, "This really surprises
us that you are this way. You're so much fun with this little one, you know? And we thought Dad would be the one to be fun. You know, we just really didn't expect this from you. But the only thing they remember is that irritableness and the unreasonableness, you know? And I said, but this is the way I was when you were little. But they don't remember that. You know, they just remember that in-between time. So we're getting the opportunity to renew our acquaintance, to get to know each other, to develop a new kind of relationship that has a lot of meaning to it and a lot of depth. I have learned so much from this program. I have gone through a metamorphosis. I like to think that I'm entirely different than I used to be, but I don't think so. I think I've gone back to what I was before alcoholism intervened in my life. I think I was just kind of sidetracked for a period of time. But I have the standards and the morals and the goals, you know, that I had way back when, you know, and it's pretty exciting. I'm what's known as a survivor. I survived alcoholism. I don't have a T-shirt like that. You know, I survived. Today, I don't survive. Today, I live. Today, I enjoy life. I found that happiness that I was looking for. I found it, that it came from within. It was my responsibility to take care of my happiness. I unfairly put that burden on the shoulders of my husband and said, "You do it for me." Well, I found out through this program that I had to do it for myself. And it's real neat. I'm happy today. The epitome of family life for me had always been the Waltons. You know, I told you I watched television. The Waltons had such a together family. They never seemed to have any situation that they couldn't work through or resolve. And they had a closeness and a bond between them. And that's where our family is today, you know. I had to really take another look at that storybook situation and realize that, yeah, they did have some problems, but they have that method of working through it. And they stuck together and they supported each other and there was love there, unconditional love, no matter what happened in that family. And that's the gift that God and Al-Anon have given to me today, you know, is that type of life. And I'm really excited about it. I truly do enjoy life today, and I truly am happy, and I truly do love my husband, and I really am grateful for being invited here this weekend. Thank you.